State lawmakers look at picking up the stimulus funds the governor left on the table. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 20th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Tanana school officials ask the state for help with budget shortfalls.
If we don't get some relief, we will have to make a choice quickly here as to whether or not we're going to pay our vendors or the school teachers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
The state Senate today introduced a resolution that would accept any federal economic stimulus money Governor Palin turns down. Yesterday, she indicated her acceptance of less than 70% of the $930 million to which the state is entitled. Pointing to the effects on Alaska of the national economic situation, the resolution certifies the acceptance of all stimulus money available to the state and all its political subdivisions. Meanwhile, Governor Palin this morning began facing opposition to her decision that left $288 million on the table.
I think this is the best question. It's about managing expectations.
She met with a group of about 75 protesters on the steps of the Capitol this morning, saying that she had not rejected any of the federal money and that all of it is up for discussion. Joining us from the Capitol is APRN's Dave Donaldson. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Dave, yesterday we thought she was rejecting half of the stimulus money, but that's not the case. What happened?
Well, half was the number that was used during the press conference. It was in the press release that went out. It was all the numbers, and nobody had actually seen the numbers until that had happened. Late in the afternoon, a new set of numbers appeared. That was never corrected officially by the governor's office, but the Office of Management Budget released the numbers, and it actually came out that she accepted nearly 70% instead of 55%. You know, it was not corrected, but hey, we'll work with what we got.
Well, she said today that she hasn't rejected anything, that all that federal money is on the table for discussion. Wasn't yesterday's announcement a rejection of a substantial amount of the package?
Yes, and the understanding of it depends on who you're talking to. I mean, you know, she didn't have a problem yesterday with letting reporters ask about being a rejection. And, you know, there was nothing open-ended in anything. I mean, she specifically said she is accepting just 55% of the available money, and that's a direct quote. You know, some legislators yesterday were saying she just punted on some of the decisions with the rest of the money. But, you know, it's a semantic question. I mean, you know, what? I'm not going to go try to define what the difference is between not accepting and rejecting.
Dave, what are you hearing? Are there specific things that legislators want to include that the governor has left out?
There are some general things they want. Of course, the big one is the education money. There's been a big play for getting that accepted. There's been a big arguments that the governor was incorrect in her assumptions on it. It's gotten far and away the biggest response here within the Capitol. However, there's, you know, weatherization money, energy money. Some people don't understand turning down anything for public safety. You know, there's a supporter for everything that's out there. The problem is that what doesn't yet exist is a detailed list of projects that the governor doesn't want. You know, there's a placeholder on the Office of Management and Budget's website for that. But, you know, here we are 18 hours after the announcement, and last I checked, which was not just a few minutes ago, it still isn't there.
Well, what projects do we know about?
For example, and this is one of the things that was pointed out to me today, in turning down the weatherization or the energy efficiency money, the governor said it would require a statewide building code. Well, you know, there are a lot of arguments against that. You know, not many people really want one, and it's not really practical in a state like Alaska. But those who have actually studied the federal bill say that, you know, the law requires an energy efficiency standard within the next 8 years. And that's designed to assure that the money is actually going to projects that are going to save fuel. you know, the state already has something like that with its energy rebate program. There are actually inspections to show how much money you're saving on energy saving projects around your home, and it's you know, it affects the amount of money you get, and that seems to be where legislators are having a problem with the governor, is over this sort of definition, the information, the details of exactly what is required.
So what's next?
The governor's bill will get quick hearings. Meanwhile, the details on what is left on the table will be coming out. They believe it now is going to be an April 3rd deadline. That's the one the governor has specified that she's got to sign something. There is no real certainty as to when everybody else has to take any further actions, but they figure, well, April 3rd is a good target to shoot for. So this resolution will likely pass very quickly, and the whole thing will be finished in the next 2 weeks. And it's that kind of a quick deadline on things, and it's got to be done, and then they got to start spending.
All right, Dave, thanks for that update.
My pleasure.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. The Tanana School District is seeking state assistance to help pay off $200,000 in debt. Tanana Superintendent John Bania says the district's financial plight stems from fuel purchased at the peak of the market last summer, a new, more expensive health insurance plan, teacher raises, and carryover debt.
When I came on board here last August, I came across over $100,000 worth of invoices from the last school year and some from the year previous to that were not paid, so we had to take care of that.
Bania says the district also suffered a 30% enrollment drop last fall that reduced state funding. 43 students are currently enrolled. The district is working with state legislators and the governor's office to come up with a solution. Bania says the governor's rural advisor John Moeller visited Tanana yesterday to meet with local officials and discuss the situation. Bania says without financial help, the district will face a tough decision.
If we don't get some relief, we will have to make a choice quickly here as to whether or not we're going to pay our vendors or whether we're going to be able to pay the school teachers as per their contracts.
Bania says if the district doesn't get any help, teachers may have to be paid after July 1st with money from next year's budget, effectively pushing the debt ahead another year. He says he's optimistic the state will solve the problem, citing precedents in which other troubled schools have been bailed out. He says the Tanana School can live within a roughly $1 million budget next year if the past debt is eliminated. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a population decline in Southeast Alaska.
The baby boomers in Southeast are now grown, and many of them have left and gone away to college, etc.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
The Alaska State High School basketball tournaments are taking place in Anchorage this week. The big schools are still playing, but the small school contests have already wrapped up. In the 1A boys division, the Kalskag Grizzlies prevailed as the champions, even after a fire destroyed their school and basketball court. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has the story.
The Kalskag Grizzlies were competing in the Kenai Peninsula tournament this January when they got word that their school back home had burned to the ground. Head coach Severin Gardner says that tournament offered a chance for his team to face some stiff competition.
I think that road trip really showed how we had to play to get into the state tournament and win it.
The Grizzlies were coming off a second place finish last year and were on a mission to take it all this go around. Gardner says the school and community spent the whole year supporting that goal.
The gym was open in Kalskag all summer. A lot of these boys were in there playing hard, working hard every day.
The Kenai tournament showed Gardner that his team would need some new plays and strategies to win. But to pull that off, they would need a court, which the fire had destroyed. The Grizzlies were forced to convert the elementary school cafeteria into their new practice space. They raised the short rims to 10 feet and made use of a cramped space that measured 40 feet at its longest.
We were space
socially challenged.
That's senior point guard DJ Doris. He says the team had to forget about those new plays Coach Gardner was talking about.
There wasn't too much room to run any offense or anything.
The team focused instead on their physical play and running tight one-on-one defense. After winning the Greater Kuskokwim Regional Tournament in a series of blowouts, Kalskag got some help from their upriver neighbor, who allowed them to practice on their court.
We traveled to Antioch, and I was the one teacher schoolhouse type thing, and I taught all these kids from 8 to 2, and then we practiced from 4 to 6.
At the state tournament, Kalskag squeezed by Napuskiak and then Elam. In the final, they faced off against New Halen. The two teams exchanged the lead throughout the game, and New Halen jumped on top in the final quarter. In the last few minutes, Kalskag switched to the one-on-one defense they had practiced. That shut down New Halen's 6'3" utility player, Robert Clay, who had been scoring at will. Kalskag senior Dennis Aloysius helped them pull away with three-point shooting he can only describe as a miracle.
That's the most and best I've done throughout the season.
Aloysius drained 8 three-pointers to give his team a 71-57 victory. The win was Kalskag's first ever state championship. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Twenty years ago next Tuesday, the nation's worst oil spill happened. The tanker Exxon Valdez went aground and ripped itself open on the top end of Prince William Sound. The event shocked the nation. The oil lay on the water for days. Journalists from around the world thronged to the small town of Valdez to report on the spill. One of them was APRN's Steve Heimel, who gives us this remembrance of the events of 20 years ago.
The spill was 2 days old by the time I got a seat on the small air carrier that flew to Valdez. The pilot deliberately flew over the tanker so we could see it. There was an oil slick that stretched as far as we could see, and a few things that looked like toothpicks surrounding the vessel. Those toothpicks were the few pieces of oil spill containment boom that had so far been deployed. There were two small boats there collecting oil. In the town itself, a news conference was going on at the Civic Center. Exxon announcing it was taking over control of the spill from the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, which was still digging its response equipment out from under the snow. Exxon was also promising to pay for any damages. And already fishermen like Doris Lopez were not believing the company.
It's so hard. They have to take the predictions of the salmon. There's no possible way to tell what hasn't shown up, and I don't see how they're going to come up with fair claims.
Much the same was said by fisherman Ricky Ott, whose education was in marine science.
I think that we're faced right now with short-term and long-term damages, and the long-term damages are going to be extremely hard to prove.
An even more harsh assessment 20 years ago came from herring spotter Jim Brown.
They have no conception of what they're talking about when they say that they're going to replace our fish stocks, and they're going to hire their attorneys to sweep us under the table.
The mayor of Valdez reacted to the news conference with disappointment. Exxon said it was going to try to use chemicals to disperse the oil. Mayor John Devens wondered if the industry had ever been serious about being able to actually go out and mechanically pick up spilled oil.
We've been told for years that they were ready for any contingency, and here we've got an oil spill, a major disaster right in our backyard under ideal conditions, and after 72 hours, we've picked up 3,000 barrels of oil. That's not very much.
The ideal conditions disappeared that night. A storm blew in, and the following day, Exxon shipping head Frank Iarossi had to make a glum announcement to his next news conference.
What happened was our worst fears, and that those very high winds last night, gusts up to 73 miles an hour, essentially stampeded that slick out of the center of Prince William Sound, over to the western edge, and down in a essentially southwesterly direction. It's unbelievable. That slick is moving like it's on a superhighway.
Everyone was in crisis mode, he said. The Civic Center was soon hosting back-to-back news conferences throughout the day. The fishermen, the Coast Guard, the scientists, the state, all started having news conferences of their own. The next day, they all flew down to a town meeting in Cordova, home to most of the fishing fleet, and the greeting they got was not at all friendly.
The
Frank Iarossi did not attend that meeting. The boos were directed at George Nelson, president of Alyeska, the company that had now proved its incapability to deal with the spill to the entire world. Exxon sent executive Don Cornett to the meeting. Cornett told the fishermen that Iarossi was still in crisis mode and was needed back at the command center to supervise the delicate operation of getting the oil out of the tanker's hulk in such a way that it did not capsize. Cornett was even more full of assurances to the fishermen than Iarossi.
We will consider whatever it takes to keep you whole. Put it on paper and bring it to the table.
History would be the judge of that promise. It came out pretty much like the fishermen predicted it would on the first day. As for the spill response, the federal government had stepped in after the storm and taken over. What was called a unified command had been formed, consisting of Exxon, the state, and the Coast Guard. The state chose to open its side of that triangle to the fishermen, something that by this time was agreeable to all parties because their basic knowledge of the current's geography and disposition of vulnerable resources was indispensable for what was by then crisis mode for all of them. Commander of the Marine Safety Office, Steve McCall, could only say this to the fishermen at the town meeting in Cordova.
I guess what I'm saying is it's a very frustrating job from my end, from the other resource agencies, to combat a quantity of oil such as was spilled in Prince William Sound. But we're trying as best as we can. Thank you.
Reporting with the Sound of 20 years ago in Cordova and Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
For some Alaskans, the Exxon Valdez oil spill changed the direction of their lives. Patience Anderson Faulkner was living in Cordova at the time. Now she's president of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council and tries to make sure the lessons learned after the spill are never forgotten.
It's not an old story. It's a story that's ongoing.
Anderson Faulkner was recently in Washington, D.C., advocating to keep the practice of tugs guiding vessels out of the Valdez port, even when all the tankers are double-hulled. Current regulations say only single-hulled vessels must be escorted. Anderson Faulkner says her memories of the spill's aftermath are fresh.
Cordova was a little insane. I always say we were invaded, first of all, by our fishermen came back very quickly. They weren't prepared to come back because it wasn't quite our season. So we had people just scrambling to get everything ready to go out there and respond to the cleanup. Then we had a wave of news people that were wanting to find out what the heck was going on.
Anderson Faulkner says that was followed by a wave of lawyers and a wave of people helping with the cleanup. She says Cordova transformed overnight.
Getting everyone settled and while we were unsettled was a big challenge. There weren't enough hotels, there weren't enough restaurants, there weren't enough workers. Everyone was on pins and needles. And it took most of the summer for things to settle down so we could do things somewhat in a routine basis.
Anderson Faulkner says despite the depression, anger, and hopelessness the spill brought, people in Cordova rallied together and stepped up to help.
What I found in Cordova was that our leadership, and I wasn't a leader, I was just a Cordovan. Our leadership was so impacted by the media, by the lawyers, by the community, that they were almost paralyzed. I mean, they were grieving themselves, and they just didn't have the support. So it was very, very difficult for everybody.
Anderson Faulkner says working for the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council has given her direction. She represents Cordova District Fishermen United on the council and as an Aleut also belongs to the Chugach Alaska Corporation. She says her work on the council includes everything from counseling depressed fishermen to working with government and the oil industry to make sure regulations and supervision don't relax in the sound.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
In the last 8 years, Southeast Alaska has lost more population than any other region around the state. That's according to the latest population estimates from the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development. From Station KRBD in Ketchikan, Deanna Garrison reports.
Southeast Alaska saw a drop of nearly 4,000 residents between April of 2000 and July 1st of last year. Greg Williams is a state demographer.
Southeast has lost more population or had a larger population loss than any other part of the state since 2000. Part of that is that we are the oldest part of the state, which contributes to that to some degree. And some of the losses that we've had are many of the children, all the baby boomers in Southeast are now grown and many of them have left and gone away to college, et cetera.
Williams says the region experienced a slight increase in population last year of 231 residents. He says Southern Southeast saw the biggest decline in residents over the last 8 years.
Part of that, of course, was losses down there with the mill and the shutdown and the logging. Certainly has contributed to Ketchikan's loss since that time.
Ketchikan lost 1,066 residents between 2000 and 2008. Prince of Wales Island saw a drop of 797 people during that time. Population on the island was 5,360 last year. Every major population center in the region saw declines. Between 2000 and 2008, Juneau saw its population decline by 284 people. Petersburg's population dropped 413 people. Wrangell lost 336 residents, and Sitka's population dropped by 220. State economist Alyssa Shanks says the population losses have paralleled declines in the region's traditional economic sectors.
Fishing has done much better in the past, and timber has definitely seen better days. Mining, the same. We lost some mining just this last year, and that may or may not come back. There's less and less reason for people to stick around.
Despite declines in seafood, timber, and mining, Shanks says overall employment in the region increased by 100 jobs last year. Williams says the state's population has grown by nearly 53,000 since the 2000 census, up 5,000 last year.
Most of that growth has been pretty much through natural increase in the last 3 or 4 years. Actually, we're having slight out-migration from the state as a whole.
A natural increase is the number of births minus deaths. Williams says the Mat-Su Valley is the area of the state that has grown the most over the last 8 years.
Although the growth there has slowed down a little bit, it's been growing at about 4% a year since about 1990. But this last year, it slowed down to about 3.5%. But it's still the fastest growing part of the state.
Williams says the population estimates are based on the 2000 census and changes in permanent fund applications. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
A Washington, D.C. company has given up federal permits to study the potential for tidal power generation at two sites in southeast Alaska. Washington, D.C.-based Alaska Tidal Energy surrendered its Federal Energy Regulatory Commission preliminary permits for tidal power in the Wrangell Narrows near Petersburg and Icy Passage near Gustavus. KFSK's Jovik Nicky reports.
The company's February 28th filing says Alaska Tidal Energy has conducted a detailed review of the developmental potential of the Icy Passage and Wrangell Narrows sites. However, the document says while each of the sites has sufficient tidal energy resources, serviceable markets, and interconnection options do not satisfy the company's criteria at this time. Alaska Tidal President Mike Hoover declined a recorded interview this month, but said the two southeast sites were too remote and they did not see the funding available from the state of Alaska that the company had hoped for. Alaska Tidal had applied for a $1.9 million grant from the state's Renewable Energy Fund, but the state did not recommend that project for funding. The company was hoping to use the money for testing prototype devices and studying the feasibility of developing generators in the Wrangell Narrows, as well as the Icy Passage site near Gustavus and sites near Angoon and in Cook Inlet by Nikiski. In their review for the state grant request, staff said the four sites were less than optimal. The Alaska Energy Authority cited existing cheap energy in Petersburg and Nikiski and hydropower projects already under development for Gustavus and Angoon. David Lockard is the Ocean and River Energy Program Manager with the Alaska Energy Authority. He says the sites like the Wrangell Narrows currently have limited economic incentive because of existing power sources.
The hydroelectric capacity for the Wrangell-Petersburg region is very significant. There's excess power anticipated on that grid for
at least 8 to 10 years, even though the Suantai intertie is being completed in 2009. And so the economic incentive to build a tidal energy project there is pretty limited.
Alaska Tidal also surrendered two other federal permits last year for Kachemak Bay and Gastineau Channel near Juneau, but the company holds onto its permit for the Nikiski project. Other companies are also still studying tidal generation at various sites around the state. Lockard says Alaska has 95% of the nation's tidal energy potential and says the focus of the technology at the moment looks to be in Cook Inlet.
It does seem to be at Homer. The city of Homer is also pursuing an assessment of the resource and the potential for a project there. I would say partly because Cook Inlet is a very significant tidal resource, the second largest tidal resource in North America, and also because it's adjacent to the Rail Belt grid, which of course is by far the largest grid and largest load in the state.
Tidal energy generation is a relatively new and emerging technology. Lockard says 2008 saw the first commercial utility-scale tidal and wave energy projects commissioned in the world. Those projects were off the coasts of Scotland and Portugal. Lockard says the study of tidal, in-river, and wave power generation are behind other renewable energy sources.
Hydrokinetics is, some people say, is 20 years behind where wind energy is today. And there's been a lot of experience and lessons learned from wind technology, which are applicable to hydrokinetic technology. And I'm thinking specifically of the importance of siting, designing, and operating the devices to minimize environmental impacts.
In Alaska, there's continuing study of in-river power generation at various sites around the state, as well as wave energy being studied near Yakutat. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Viknicki.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, and Joe Viknicki in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska State Elks Association, committed to eliminating the use and abuse of illegal drugs in support of a drug-free environment. Information at alaskastateelks.org. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.